supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we often say, have faith, or I'm a person of faith. But what do we mean by that word? What actually is faith? Is it tied to God, a God, institutional religion, or a personal way of looking at life, a worldview? Today's guest, editor and writer Victoria Zackheim, posed this question of faith to 24 writers and compiled an anthology of their deepest thoughts on their own beliefs. She joins us to start this conversation about believers, non-believers, and, hopefully, tolerance. Later, two of her contributors, Malachy McCourt and Amanda Anyadi, will join us to talk about their essays. And, of course, we want to hear your phone calls and your thoughts about faith. 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Victoria, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for writing this book. So why did you do it? Why did you write a book about faith? You did not come from a religious background at all, quite
not at all. Not at all. And I think that it was one of those things that I kept putting off as the decades were passing. And then I finally got to a place in my life where I had to ask myself, what do I believe? What is important to me? What is it that moves me? And why am I so moved? And it just kept evolving into bigger and bigger questions until I finally contacted my agent and said, what do you think about this idea for an anthology? And she said, let's do it. That's all I had to hear.
You said that, well, a couple of things. First of all, that was not your title. You didn't want that title, Faith. And you said you still were not all that comfortable with that word.
Well, the problem with the title of Faith is more how it's positioned. If you go into a bookstore, it could be in the Christian section. It could be in the spiritual section. It could be in the anthology section. And so it's a very difficult book to place, and therefore it sometimes gets lost. And people look at the title and they immediately think, it's all about believing in God. But, of course, that's not what the book is about at all. Okay. I wanted at first to call it What Do I Believe or What Do You Believe, and then have the authors who were contributing essays respond to that question. But Beyond Words is a wonderful publisher, and they said, no, we really have to put that on the cover, and so we did.
I want to ask another question about your opening statement, when you said about the big questions. And I want to pick up on one word. You said as you aged, you had to ask the big question. Why?
Well, I think it's because growing up, in a family of, there were many atheists in my family. My parents were what were called red diaper babies.
Yeah, why don't you give us a quick definition of what it means to be a red diaper?
My definition is those children born of a lot of the Eastern European Jews who came to the States, and even though the people here thought of them as communists, they really were more socialists than anything. Right. And they would carry their babies to rallies and to meetings, and so they were called red diaper babies.
Many of them, and I've had them in my family, they are passionate atheists.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think I refer somewhere in the book to the concept of being a mean atheist, which is there was a sense among many atheists that if you believe in God, that there must be something terribly wrong with you, that you must be stupid. And growing up, I didn't think very much about the different sides of that because I grew up in a family of atheists. And I remember my third grade teacher coming to our door in public school, knocking on the door and telling my mother in front of me that if we didn't convert from Judaism to Christianity, that we were all going to hell. And I remember the anger, the controlled anger of my mother at that time. And growing up with a lot of that, as I did, it made me think more of religion than it did of faith. And so I was able to put off the subject for a very long time.
What's the difference, Victoria, in your mind? What's the difference between religion and faith?
To me, religion is an organized concept of there are rules and tenets and covenants that you must follow. And faith, for me, is not so much about religion, but about a belief in something, whatever it is. It could be God, it could be the power of the universe, it could be one's own inner strength. But it's what you, as I said, and several of the authors wrote about this, what do you feel at 3 in the morning when you wake up and you're feeling angry or you're feeling upset or fearful? What do you turn to? Do you go outside yourself and ask for help, or do you go back into yourself and try to figure out what it is that you can do to make things work for you? And that's what I love about this anthology, is that we have such diverse ways of approaching the concept of faith, from the very religious and strong beliefs of Marl Pearl and Ann Perry to the sort of anti-religion rant of Malachi McCourt, and then so many in between.
So, now, you know this is a psychology-based show, right?
Right.
Right. Ha ha, the laughter. So, are you a woman of faith, and what do you mean by that?
I'm a woman of strong faith, but I'm not sure what I mean by that. For me, it's an ongoing exploration. Whether or not there's a God, whether or not there's a power of the universe, whatever there is, I'm comfortable living with it at the moment, and I'm still exploring and trying to figure it out.
So what do you mean you're a woman of faith? What is that to you?
I have a very strong belief in the goodness of people, even though sometimes it's difficult to hold on to that when you look at the news or read the paper. But then you see what's happening in Ferguson or in Iraq or in this country, in politics, in religion, and you think there's got to be, we have to have some faith to keep this thing going until we figure it out. But for me, it's just an inner sense that I have a purpose in my life, that there is purpose to life, that we're all part of a large system of working together, and really it all comes down to mutual respect and kindness.
Yeah, and you know, many who say that's the basis of all religions, I mean, it's certainly one of the fundamental basis of Judaism, of Buddhism, of, you know, and we're going to hear later on in the show from Amanda and Yadi, who's from the Baha'i faith. And
yes.
It sounds like that faith also.
It's fascinating. Of course, she was forced to leave Iran when she was a child and had to make an entirely new life for herself.
What questions did you ask these? I don't know if they're friends of yours, but they're certainly authors, multiply published authors and fairly well known. What questions did you ask those 24?
Let me just say quickly that some of them are friends, but basically I went to authors I believed would be able to write about this, whatever position they took. There were several I didn't know at all, but I knew their work, like Amanda and IAG. We hadn't met, but I knew her work, and I respected her writing enormously. It was fascinating, really, because there were a few writers I absolutely was certain what they believed. Jacqueline Michard, 8 children, writes about, you know, God and uses God a lot in her conversations. And when she came back to me and said, "I want to write about being a God-fearing atheist," I was truly surprised. And with Caroline Levitt, whom I've known for years and I was sure was an atheist, and she came back and she wanted to write about her beliefs and her spirituality, it was fascinating for me. But I chose them because I felt that these were writers who had something strong to say, and I would never have done a book on faith without inviting Malachi McCourt.
I'm really looking forward to talking with him also in just a few minutes. Faith and belief, you know, my experience is that there can be two very different things and in many respects opposite. To me, if you just look at it on a visceral level, on a cellular level, Victoria, belief is what we hold on to.
Yes.
And faith, to me, is about letting go. I mean, the phrase have faith feels like, doesn't it? Just letting go.
You know, when you are faced with something that's painful or challenging, and you wonder if you can go on. I mean, I think your point is an excellent one. The whole idea of letting go, if you believe that there's something there that will either guide you or help you survive emotionally or physically, it's that letting go, I think, is so important. There are so many ways in psychology that we can let go and allow ourselves to step back and be able to see things more clearly and feel, and maybe even feel things more clearly. But I discovered with this particular anthology, because I had done anthologies before this on infidelity, on body image, existential questions, but this was the one where the authors were the most confused, I guess I could say, where they kept coming back to me over and over again saying, well, what do you mean? What do you want me to write about? And I said to them, what do you believe? That's really what it's about. What do you believe? And I used the when you're alone or when you're afraid, where do you go? In your head, to your heart, outside? What do you believe that keeps you moving? And I had so many questions about that, whereas some of the other anthologies I've done, there were very few questions. They knew where they were going to go with it, but this was a real interesting
You keep talking about belief, but you had two questions in there. What do you feel? And what do you believe? And is faith a feeling or a belief?
Oh, that's a difficult question, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
what I'm saying. I turn it back to you and ask you what you think.
To me, faith is a feeling. And I find security when I feel faith, when I'm able to just let go. I wrote in one of my books about, I wrote a chapter about faith, and you know, I was asked to define it over and over and over again in my talks, and I, you know, like everybody else, I fumbled through it. And then I remembered back to when I learned to float, and there we were treading water, like all of us do, and I raised the question, what's the difference between those who were able to float and those who sink? And the difference is letting go. It's an act of faith.
Yes. Giving
your body over to that body of water and having faith that it will hold you, even though you have no idea how that's going to work. I still don't, by the way.
I think it's an excellent analogy, because the whole idea of trusting yourself, trusting the world, that if you can let go, then I think extraordinary things can happen.
Yeah.
And you're not fighting yourself. When you're treading water, you're fighting the elements, in a sense, to keep yourself upright. But if you can just get onto your back and just relax and let go and trust, it will make that difference. And, of course, it makes all the difference when children are able to do it. It gives them a tremendous sense of empowerment.
Let me reintroduce you here for listeners who are just tuning into the show. We're talking with Victoria Sackheim. She's the editor of Faith, Essays from Believers, Agnostics, and Atheists. And she's also done many other books and really interesting projects. Later on, we're going to hear from two of the people who contributed to that book. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What do you believe? What does faith mean to you? And how have your life experiences shaped the way you experience faith or shaped your beliefs? Again, that's 888-477-9499. You know, your story began in 1985, when your daughter's 15-year-old best friend died suddenly of a bacterial infection. And your language was, you looked inside and found nothing. Take us the next few steps in that process.
Well, as you know, when your children are distraught and lost, feeling lost, as a 15-year-old girl would be after having lost a dear, dear friend, literally overnight, the first thing you do is you give to your children, and you try to give them strength. You try to give them that sustenance, that emotional support. But there comes a time when you have to pay attention to what's going on inside yourself. And what I realized was that Lizzie's death had left me numb, in a sense. Any belief I had, I pushed aside. There's that anger, that little nut of anger that works its way into one's heart and soul when something happens that just feels so terribly unfair. And it took a very long time for me to be more accepting, not only the fact that a child could die, because children are not supposed to die, but that the universe does go on, and that by grieving so deeply and so steadily for this child, in a sense, I began to feel that I was dismissing who she was in those 15 years that she lived. And I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna about it, but she had an exciting life, and she touched a lot of people. And I felt I needed to take a look at that as well. And it helped. It really helped me a lot. And I think it also helped my daughter that we began to talk about the wonderful things, the funny things that happened.
How does this begin your journey to explore faith and maybe even disavow that passionate atheism you grew up with?
One of the things for me was watching the girl's mother and how she pulled herself together and was able to move on with such strength and determination. And it made me think, you know, where is she finding this? How is she able to do that? If it had been one of my children, I'm not sure I would have survived. But then I watched her, and I thought, yes, I would have survived, perhaps not as well as she is. But she was a role model for me of moving on, not forgetting ever, but saying, you know, my life also has value. I need to keep going. If I stop, what am I saying about me and my relationship with my child? My child would not want this. So I won't say one of those, excuse the expression, aha moments, but it certainly pushed me a bit toward wondering, what is going on here? And in a funny way, it wasn't that different than the feeling I had standing on the coast at Big Sur and looking at the magnificent view, that filling up of emotion and thinking, this doesn't come just from looking at something beautiful. This comes from something far more profound, something far deeper. And I began to feel that after Lizzie's death, and when I began to accept that it had happened, fair or not, it was reality. And moving on, I found myself moving along a path of different exploration, and it just began to move that way. Don't forget, 85 was a long time ago, and I was a very young woman then. So that path has been a long journey. I don't think I'll ever come to the end of it. I think that it's just a journey that I'm on, and I'm fascinated by it. But sometimes it's not easy, as you know. It can be very painful as well.
No, it's not easy. And you're talking about standing on at Big Sur, and I've had that feeling also. Both at Big Sur, last year I was in South Africa and on safari, and I felt that also. And it reminded me of a line from a Rilke poem that I've quoted here on the show before, but I think it's the opening line where he says, "I'm too small in this world and not small enough to make every moment holy." And in that moment, that moment is holy.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever holy means to you, that's that moment of faith.
It can also be just looking into the face of someone you love, knowing that they're loving you back.
Yeah.
A child, whatever, a grandchild, a friend. It's that moment that there's that connection of the heart and of the soul.
Well, you know, in many religions and mine, ours, and in Judaism, the phrase "God is one," and my take on that is, when two people are as one, that's divine. But what do I know? I'm a psychologist.
Not easy to come by, but when it happens, yes.
Oh, you can do it with practice. It gets easier.
We have to have faith.
It really does. Well, that's a good note to take a break on, because I want you'll stick with us while we speak.
Absolutely.
With Malachy McCourt, who's coming up right after the break. And after our second break, we're going to be speaking with Amanda Enyaedi, who's also an author and columnist. We're talking about faith here on Voices in the Family and belief. What is it? What does it mean to you? How do you answer the big questions about what is your life? What is life all about? Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has worked to provide loving and clinical care to some of the most vulnerable members of society, including individuals on the autism spectrum. Austin, who first attended a Devereaux school at age 5, was almost entirely unable to communicate. Through a combination of his mother's advocacy, his hard work, and the support of Devereaux, he said, "I love you," to his mother for the first time. More about Devereaux's programs and services online at devereaux.org.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about faith on today's show. We've been talking with Victoria Zackheim, who started this whole thing going with her book called Faith, Essays from Believers, Agnostics, and Atheists. And speaking of the latter, we've got Malachy McCourt joining us today, and the title of his essay is "I Am an Atheist, Thank God." So, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan, and I'm delighted to be on WHYY because I have great memories of being in Philadelphia for a long run of Inherit the Wind at the courthouse there with Jason Miller some years back. We had about 7 months. And the publisher of one of my books, Running Price, happens to be there.
Yeah.
And the title of that book, which might interest you, is The History of Danny Boy, the Song.
Really?
So, okay. All kinds of connections there.
All right. Well, that one I'm going to look up. So, listen, yes. I want to come back and to your title. I'm an atheist, thank God. So
yes.
To whom are you thankful? And why are you thankful in the first place, for God's sake?
Well, it's the main reason for organized religion, as is organized crime, is extortion. And organized religion has all the elements of organized crime except the compassion. So the thing that I possess is not faith, not belief, but acceptance of what is. And I just cannot believe in a God situation, a deity, an entity that goes around telling people what to do and how to do it. And then if you don't do it, you go, he has created a place of fire, and you're supposed to, that's where you go for all eternity.
Well, what you're arguing here is, you know, the stories in the Bible, and you either say or imply, I mean, they're not reasonable and they're not real. They're not
yes.
Possible. So you're in a very, very large group of people who feel the same way. But
yeah.
Are you saying that faith and religion are the same thing?
Yeah, well, faith, no, I don't think so. I mean, I have faith in the climate. I know it's going to change. I know I'm going to get winter, I'm going to get summer, it's going to be blistering hot, it's going to be fiercely called and all that sort of thing. Religion is, as Victoria said, it's a series of rules and regulations and threats and desperate punishments for what they call sin. And then if there is this God situation, I mean, the believers say that God is omnipotent, that he knows everything, knows past, present, and future. And even the Gospel according to Matthew says that not even a sparrow falls, but God is there. In our courts, we have that legend up on the wall. Every court in America says, "In God we trust."
All right, well,
I think that God should be tried for criminality, because if you know of a crime, say you come upon a bunch of guys that are plotting to seize some airplanes, and they're going to run them into the World Trade Center and kill a whole lot of people. Now, the law is that if you don't report that, you're part of the conspiracy. So now God knew, according to what they say about religion, that these guys were going to do that and did not inform anybody about it. And thousands of people were killed.
Now, listen, you're right. Your idea is interesting. And even if we could do that, I can see it in the Supreme Court, and you know where that's going to go.
Yes.
From there. So listen. So okay. I'm a psychologist. We like to know background, and I'm judging from your accent that you, unlike Victoria, you are not a red diaper baby.
No.
Right.
No.
Right. So,
a green diaper baby.
A green diaper baby. Right.
So I was all over the place.
So. I mean, what religion were you born into? What were you told to believe?
Catholicism. The one Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church was started me off. And it was like ecclesiastical terrorism growing up in Ireland, with the threats all the time about the flesh, all sins of the flesh. And if you did this, didn't do that, and you had to obey. Even the Constitution, the Irish Constitution, has a special little provision, Article 4, which gives the Catholic Church a special place in the affairs of the country. It took me, because they said if you want whatever you want, you know, as a kid, they would say, pray for it. Well, I did a lot of praying, and I'll tell you that my sister, little kid, died. God wasn't around, apparently. Then there were two other brothers, Eugene and Oliver, twins. They died. And then I look around and say, well, where is, why does God, this God guy do that? That's what... So the fact is that children in poverty, we were in desperate poverty, as my brother wrote in Angela's Ashes, and but then I've come to the conclusion that's the way things are.
I want to, you know, I asked Victoria a therapy question, and I feel it would be unjust if I didn't ask you one. I read your chapter. I listened to you now. And to be honest, there's a quality of anger,
yes,
in what I'm listening to, and so I understand why. But to whom are you angry at? Where is it directed?
I'm not sure, Dan. It's sort of, but I think I'm less angry than I used to be because of the colossal waste of time. Waste of energy on being watching out for the sin, and thinking about praying to God about what I said was what I think is that I am accepting. You see, there would be no religion if there were not fear of the hereafter. That's what motivates people, because nobody knows what happens after death. Science doesn't know about the beginning of the world because they are speculating all the time. Religion goes on about God creating a place to, as my brother said, he made the world so that he could have something to stand on. And then he creates man,
well,
Adam.
We could also argue that religion is also about controlling our own impulse. You know, thou shalt not kill. I mean, do we need to have that in the
Ten? I don't think
would
so.
Would we be killing if it,
no? I mean, that's, you know, a lot of old rubbish.
So it's about our fear of our own impulses, which is,
well, they're always confusing lack of or atheism, as people say. They're always confusing it with being amoral or lacking morality and so forth. It has nothing to do with. My thing is that people have basic instincts, and they have to do with getting food, procreating, sex, and that sort of thing. And it doesn't have anything. And people are not naturally criminals.
But don't you think, Maliki, that centuries ago, millennia ago, that a lot of these doctrines were put into place because the church didn't trust the common man to make good, rational, ethical decisions? I'm not saying that they were justified in doing it. Yeah. I'm wondering if that was one of the reasons why all of those thou shalt not were put before us, as if we couldn't make those decisions ourselves.
Well, and the church was consisted of, you know, humans who were also afraid of their own.
Princes and kings were also cardinals. They had secular and religious powers all over the place. And
yes.
And you know that the word nepotism comes from nephew of the Pope, because the Pope had children, but they were not his children. They were his nephews. And that's how, if I give my nephew a job, that's how nepotism came about.
Let me interrupt both of you for a minute. I've been inviting people to call the show to join the conversation, and I've been hogging you. Let's turn to the phones. We've got David on the line. Hi, David.
Hi there.
What's your...
Dan, I listen to your show when I have the time and I'm driving during the noontime hour. I'm happy to take part in your program today. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So what's your comment?
So I am a guy who, I'm in my mid-50s. I'm a scientist, a chemist by training. I grew up as a Catholic boy, going to church every Sunday. I went to a four-year Catholic boys' high school, quite enveloped in the Catholic religion for those years, certainly. And as I grew into my adulthood as a scientist and thought a lot about the origin of the universe and scientific principles that guide physics, I began to believe in a God that was a creator, but at the intersection of theology and physics, someone who created that particle that blew apart in the Big Bang to set our universe on course. And I often describe my faith, if you want to call it that, as an explanation of a being of some sort that must have created that particle before it exploded. And I sort of wonder if other people share that kind of view.
Well, David, you almost quoted a conversation I had with my rabbi 10 years ago when he said he believes what's happening is divinely inspired, and the rest is up to science and humankind. David, thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate it. Really, really interesting how you integrated both. I want to switch gears a minute and come back to you, Maliki, if
yes,
I may.
Done.
So you referred to 12-step programs in your article.
Yes.
I don't know if you use that language per se, but you suggested that these are merely people looking to one another for help to stay sober. Well, I've got to tell you, some people stay away from 12-step programs because they're too focused on, and you hear the phrase in 12-step programs, my higher power, which I choose to call God.
Yes.
So it's much more than people just looking to one another for help staying sober. The whole program is divinely inspired. Not divinely inspired. I mean, it's based on religious tenets.
Well, it's I find that I have been sober now for 30 years, and I do not have to proclaim my belief in a God or a God as I understand him or anything else like that. All I know is that that my friends in the program have helped me stay sober over the years. I accept that that's the way. Mm. That's what it is for me. I hear people invoking Jesus and all kinds of things in these at these meetings, but that's not my business. That's theirs.
You know,
I
remember I spent many years in Al-Anon, and I remember the phrases as I listened to you talk, Maliki, take what you like and leave the rest.
And leave the rest, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I do. And it's a joyful, wonderful experience to be sober. I am free. You see, I have no fear, no hope, I should say, of a heaven. And I have no fear of hell. So I am, those burdens are not on me. I can go through the world with my hands free to give and to receive the gifts of life as they are. And I'm having a lot of fun. I mean, 80, going on 84, I don't know when I'm going to die. I'm sure it could be, you know, in the next 10 minutes, but I'll let you know if I do.
Well, yeah, please do. And
yes.
And listen, I know you you've got a problem with your leg, and you're in a physical rehab facility.
I am at the Methodist, believe it or not.
Ah.
And the last time I saw you, Maliki, you had just come out of it after having broken your leg. So you have to stop this.
I'm in and out like a fiddler's elbow. It's the Methodist Rehabilitation and Nursing Home in a Riverdale in New York City.
So they're helping you?
Oh, God, yeah. Look at that now. Oh, God, he said.
Exactly. Well, you know, thank God you're getting the help you need.
They're treating me very well, and there's good physical program here, and I'm now, you know, raising a leg occasionally, and off we go.
Well, I've got to tell you, we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Amanda and Yayadi. And Maliki McCord, I want to thank you so much.
It was a great pleasure, Maliki. Dan. And Victoria, thank you so much for this project.
Yeah, for me too.
I couldn't do it without you.
Thanks, love. All the best.
I'll take care. Bye-bye.
Take good care. Well, as you can tell, we've been talking about faith today on Voices in the Family. And when we come back, like I said, we're going to be talking with Amanda Inyadi, who's got an extraordinary story. She's an author and columnist. Victoria, you're going to stick with us for the rest of the
Absolutely.
Show?
Absolutely.
All right. And our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
For three decades, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has hosted thoughtful discussions on behavioral health on WHYY. Celebrate 30 years of Voices in the Family at a special event with Dr. Dan and friends at WHYY, Tuesday, September 8th. More at whyy.org/events.
Eastern University supports WHYY. The College of Business and Leadership programs educate and empower students to lead in the global marketplace, offering MBA programs including management and health administration, as well as both a master's and PhD in organization leadership. Eastern believes the world responds to those who believe and do. Their programs are designed to empower students to develop skills that impact the world around them. Eastern.edu/CBL. Eastern University. Don't just be, do, and wake up the world.
Your most valuable customers are WHYY's biggest fans. Reach an affluent, educated audience with an on-air message on WHYY. Call Roseanne Olin at 215-351-1223 or visit whyy.org/underwriting.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We've been talking about faith and belief with Victoria Zakheim. We just heard from Malachy McCourt. And now we're going to be speaking with Amanda Inyaiti. She's an author and columnist. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I've really been looking forward to chatting with you. I want to get to your background. You were born in Iran, and the revolution took place when you were a young girl. Your family was of the Baha'i faith, and you attended what sounded, as I read your chapter, sounded like an exclusive private school, and this was all before the revolution. Tell us what your life was like for you before the revolution and then after, when everyone had to be a Muslim.
Well, it was sort of your average childhood. I mean, believe it or not, it felt, now that I've lived in the States and I've lived in Europe, it was just your average childhood that I had in Iran. And I went to a school that had been established by the Shah. There was a test at some point, and there were a group of children that were chosen to go to this school, and I guess we had a future of service for the Shah, I suppose. I was very, very young. And so at some point in the very, very early days of the revolution, the school shut down. There was an incident where one of our buses was intercepted and turned over and put on fire.
And you, of course, you weren't on it. The children were let off.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The children were let off, and then they set the bus on fire. So it went from your average, everyday, normal childhood to just sort of a surreal scene.
Tell me about this little girl, Amanda, this little
I loved Western music. I loved a British group named Boney M. I loved American bands and ABBA. And, I mean, this was a time when Iran was just very, it was lovely. We had festivals and we had arts festivals and women with long hair and miniskirts. And
how old were you when you endured this trauma?
I was 8 and 9.
Wow, a little girl.
Yeah.
So you were discriminated against there because you were not a Muslim, you were of the Baha'i faith.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I write about this in my essay. There was a day when the teacher was going around, and this is after things had been changing, and people were on the rooftops in the dark of night chanting, "Death to the Shah, death to America." And I remember hearing it as I was trying to go to sleep and wondering how they got up on the rooftops. And So one day, after a period of people chanting and unrest, the teacher went around and asked what religion everyone was. And I had, you know, I'm a fourth, fifth generation Baha'i. And on both sides of my family, on my mother's side, our heritage was Jewish. And on my father's side, our heritage was Muslim. But we were all Baha'i for several generations.
So that's the newest religion. The world's newest religion is what it's been called.
Yes.
Just give us a brief summary of what it means.
So the Baha'i faith is a lovely, young-ish world religion. It's about 171 years old. And Baha'is basically believe in the spiritual unity of all humankind. We believe that all the prophets came from the same God. So they were progressively revealed, like your first grade, second grade, third grade teacher. They're not at odds, that they're just sort of come one after another to bring teachings.
What God do you believe in?
Well, that's funny that you ask me to define God, because I define God very broadly.
I'm channeling Victoria here.
Yes, you are. But I don't get stuck on definitions. I don't get stuck. I in when when cornered, I apply the broadest definitions because it is my hope to bring as much inclusiveness to the process as possible. There are people, dear friends, who tell me that they are atheists and they don't believe in God or they don't know, but they live these lives of faith and honor and character, and I just don't believe in those boundaries, and I don't really get stuck on the definitions.
May I interject something here?
Yeah, sure, Victoria.
Near the end of Amanda's wonderful, wonderful essay in this book, she writes about herself, and she says, she burned with wrath, with fury. She burned with justice and compassion and love, and she burned once again with faith. And then she ends it saying, she realized as she flew that her powers and blessings had grown in proportion to her faith, that her faith had solidified through the suffering, and that this had been the balance all along. And Amanda, by the way, good morning, Amanda, and thank you for coming from Amsterdam to do this. but I get a sense, just getting to know you and reading your work, that this idea of the balance is really at the heart of what you believe. Is that so?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And for me, it's really the balance between our spiritual selves and our physical selves, the balance between suffering and joy, the balance between the truths we can prove and the truths we cannot yet. So really, it's about this essential harmony of many things, including, as I know, Dan, you're a psychologist, the harmony between science and religion. That's actually one of the most important tenets of the Baha'i faith, that we don't think that, we think it's a false dichotomy, that there is no division there, that true science and true religion are one.
True religion. Now I can just hear Malachi McCourt in the back of my head and my the hairs in my neck. You said science and religion, there's no... they're always imbalanced. They can be imbalanced.
They reinforce each other.
Are you equating religion with faith?
I think that religion is a daily manifestation of your faith. Religion is not solely a Sunday practice. It's not a judgmental practice. It's not a murderous practice. It is the daily manifestation of the faith you hold dear.
I want to come back to some of your history here, because it's compelling and it's terribly important. So, you know, you move around quite a bit and you finally settle in this country, in New York, after you got married. You started having night terrors and you finally saw a therapist on September 10th, 2001. And then you said your terror came true.
Yes. So just going back a little bit, I was a child refugee from the Iranian Revolution. Eventually, I was sent out and my parents followed. But in the interim, I spent 5 years by myself in Europe living with family members and going to a boarding school. And then eventually, when everyone got out, we settled in the United States. I went to school in L.A., went to college law school back east. And when I was living back east, I had moved to New York. I was an attorney, and I started having nightmares. And they were all about war and destruction. And I had them for almost a year. And my husband thought it was just sort of, you know, I was just having bad dreams. And finally, on September 10th, I was in a therapist's office asking to be given something because I just was having panic attacks. So she told me she was going to refer me to a psychiatrist. And the next day, I was standing on 6th and Bleecker as the towers fell. So my dreams, I said, came true in a multi-sensory horror show. So,
all right, so let's fast forward several years later. You're living in the Bay Area now, and you continue to have night terrors, but this time the content of the terrors changed to radiation.
I thought there was going to be radiation. So the first thing I thought when I started having nightmares again was, oh my gosh, there's going to be another terrorist attack. And this time I kept dreaming about radiation. And so I know it's going to sound crazy, but I actually ordered these radiation pills on the internet. I ordered one set for my parents and one set for myself. And in the end, as I say, the only person who was radiated was me, because I was diagnosed as a young person with, I was the mother to a 1- and a 2-year-old. I was diagnosed with late stage cancer.
Late stage cancer.
Late stage cancer, mother of all tumors, and it had spread. I was in deep, deep trouble.
How long ago was this?
This was in August. Oh, are we in August? We're in August.
We're in August.
It's eight years.
Well, I guess happy anniversary. I don't quite.
Why, thank you.
Yeah.
Happy life.
Happy life. I would imagine if late stage, you weren't expected to live this long.
I had a horrible prognosis. I mean, it really, it had been masked. The tumor was growing in sheets instead of lumps. So even when they did, it was 9 centimeters. It was larger than 9 centimeters. And even when they did a mammogram, it didn't show up because it was growing in sheets. And I had just had children, so my breasts were very dense. But I experienced, you know, I'm not a stranger to strife, obviously, as a refugee, as a person who lived without family members, immediate family for a very long time, as a person who practiced at major law firms, you know, that's not an easy life either. So I was no stranger to strife, and yet I had a horrible crisis. I had a major crisis of faith when I was diagnosed with cancer.
You know,
well, with small children, you would understand that.
You know, I've got to summarize where we go next, because we are very short on time, but you know, you went to Israel, to a pilgrimage to the Baha'i Holy Shrines.
Yes,
which
in
is
Haifa.
In Haifa, Mount Carmel. But
absolutely.
You know, you said you felt desperate, you had questions, but you said after you left that shrine, you had your answer, and you quoted Rumi, who said, "The wound is where the light entered you."
Yes.
Tell me about
it. So I didn't understand why, despite everything that had happened to me, I was going to be tested yet again. I didn't understand why, despite the fact that I had shown nothing but resilience and happiness and joy in the face of adversity, that here I was at death's door with 2 small children in tow. And I remember this one Baha'i quote, "As ye have faith, so shall your powers and blessings be." This is the balance.
I'm going to have to ask you to bring it to an end in just a couple seconds.
Absolutely.
That's a beautiful way to end it.
Yes, that is. And it was the balance. Ultimately, for me, the balance of faith was the balance between faith and powers and blessings.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I am so grateful to you, Victoria, to Amanda,
and to you
as well. To Malachy. Thank you. And it's a wonderful book. I highly, highly recommend it. It's called Faith, Essays from Believers, Agnostics, and Atheist. I want to remind you, I've got a big 30th anniversary event on September 8th here at WHYY Studios at noon. I'll be speaking with Mike and Scott as we take a look back over my 30 years, and we look ahead to see what's next. For more information, come to whyy.org/events. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Stanishevsky. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Leah Kaufman is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Hey, please enjoy your week, my friends.